EBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mark Remillard. For the first time in 30 years, the Senate has passed a measure blocking a law passed by Washington, D.C.'s council. It's a crime bill, and 33 Democrats voted with Republicans to block it. Republican Senator Bill Hagerty of Tennessee.
It's gotten so bad that the city recently announced that it's giving away free steering wheel locks to owners of frequently stolen cars here in the district.
The resolution now goes to President Biden's desk. According to prepared remarks obtained by ABC News, Norfolk Southern CEO Alan Shaw will tell a Senate panel tomorrow that he's deeply sorry for the fiery train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio last month. The mother of Breonna Taylor, Tamika Palmer, reacting to a Justice Department report that found a pattern of constitutional violations and discriminatory policing within the Louisville Police Department.
It's heartbreaking to know that everything you've been saying from day one has to be said again. Through this manner.
The investigation was launched after Taylor was killed in a botched raid. This is ABC News. The United Nations says the Taliban has reestablished control of Afghanistan. The country has become one of the most repressive in the world for women and girls. First Lady Dr. Jill Biden hosting the annual International Women of Courage Awards at the White House on International Women's Day.
But today, we're here to tell girls everywhere the truth that they need to hear. Yes, you matter. Yes, you can make a difference.
11 women were recognized for their leadership in advocating for peace, justice, human rights, and equality around the world. The National Highway Transportation Safety Administration investigating a Tesla Model S that slammed into a fire truck last month in California as part of a larger investigation into autopilot crashes. In new guidelines, the American Optometric Association is recommending annual comprehensive eye exams for adults. The exams include things like depth perception, response to light, and eye movement, and are different than a vision screening. Mark Remillard, ABC News.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
From Green Bay to Oshkosh and Point South, wherever you are in the Fox Valley, count on us to keep you connected, informed, and entertained. Civic Media.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane McNair. Here's what you need to know. After 9 hours of sometimes heated testimony, Wisconsin's GOP lawmakers are preparing to temporarily halt updates to Wisconsin's vaccine requirements for children entering schools and daycare. Wisconsin's Department of Health Services wants to add meningitis to the list of required vaccinations. Another DHS change adds statewide criteria for identifying a substantial outbreak of chickenpox or meningitis. But Republicans say the definitions are overly strict and could be used to keep kids from attending school in person. WPR reporting many of those testifying Tuesday repeated vaccine misinformation, including the widely debunked claim that vaccines cause autism. It's pothole season in Wisconsin, and that can be pricey. When tires drop into a pothole more than a few inches below suspension levels, it can damage the muffler, tires, and rims. Insurance tends to vary between coverages. I'm Jane McNair. This is Civic Media News.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens, inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripes Cast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
I'll second guest dinners with friends because they can be interrupted by diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain, or oily stools. It turns out I have EPI, or exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, which means I'm missing the enzymes needed to digest food. My doctor prescribed Creon pancrelipase, an oral prescription medication that replaces pancreatic digestive enzymes. Creon treats EPI due to cystic fibrosis, chronic pancreatitis, pancreatectomy, or other conditions.
Creon may increase your chance of fibrosing colonopathy, a rare bowel disorder. Tell your doctor if you have a history of intestinal blockage or scarring or thickening of your bowel wall, if you're allergic to pork, or if you have gout, kidney problems, or worsening of painful swollen joints. Call your doctor if you have any unusual or severe gastrointestinal symptoms or allergic reactions. Take Creon as directed by your doctor and always with food. Do not chew capsules, as this may cause mouth irritation. Other side effects may include blood sugar changes, gas, dizziness, sore throat, and cough. These are not all the side effects of Creon.
Creon is the number one prescribed EPI treatment. Ask your doctor about Creon for EPI and visit creoninfo.com or call 800-633-9110 to learn more. That's creoninfo.com.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Hey, Joe, what do you got for us today?
In reference to Lindsey Graham, I was amazed at his comments where he said, if Trump is indicted, there will be riots in the streets. Lindsey Graham was a JAG officer, and in order to be a JAG officer, you have to pass the bar. Was a JAG officer.
I'm sorry, he's a JAG-off officer? I didn't quite understand that.
Yeah, to see a lawyer head for the rat hole instead of acting like a person with a backbone. Wow, what a profile and courage, huh?
Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m.,
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app. Keeping the Fox Valley connected, informed, and entertained, this is Civic Media. News and talk up, down, and all around the Fox Valley, Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So everybody remembers January 6th and Josh Hawley doing the big fist thing and then running. I remember the running more than the fist pump. But I got a lot of my Republican friends who go, you know, Josh Hawley's the future of the Republican Party. He's a man of the people. And look, understand, Republicans are making a true attempt at being the party of the working class. The pivot is happening right before us. And this train derailment is a big part of what they're trying to do. And Hawley's figuring out how to triangulate his way into being that working class populist while still having all of the bad ideas that got us into the mess we're in right now, which is why can't let him do it. Got to hold him accountable. And at some point, I'm hoping someone in that state in Missouri shows him the door. And I'm hoping my next guest could be that guy. That's why I've asked Lance Kuntz to come talk with us. He's a 13-year Marine veteran, also the Democrat running against Josh Hawley. Lucas, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, absolutely, Rick. It's good to be here, man.
I go back to January 6th, and I'm looking at Hawley, and I'm looking at him doing the fist pump, and I'm looking at him doing all these things, and it's not who he is.
No, I mean, the guy's a fraud, right? You're right. They're trying to do this pivot to working class, and he thinks that, getting out there pumping his fist is going to get him some power, so he's out there doing it. And then the second that things get real, he's skittering out the back door as fast as he can, right? The guy's only about power for himself. He'll do whatever it takes. He won't do whatever it takes. He'll say whatever it takes to try to get that power. But it doesn't actually change or do anything, right? The guy is a country club Republican through and through. I mean, he's a guy who, when the Iraq War started, you know, some of us experienced the Iraq War differently than others. I was there as a United States Marine. Josh Hawley is famous for popping popcorn and watching on TV and being so excited that this country was going to war. And his peers were getting killed over there. It's absolutely bananas. Like, the guy doesn't understand the working class. He doesn't understand anything about us. And you know, people in Missouri, they realize that, and they don't like him. He's not popular here. You know, his approval rating hovers around 40%. By contrast, John Tester in Montana is at like 60%, right? And so we got a real opportunity here where we can take down one of the frauds in their home state straight away and try to end this thing.
Now, Missouri, you know, in my view, has always been a very strong working class state. I mean, you know, centrist to be honest, but not crazy. I look at someone like Hawley, who does play this kind of faux populist, but sides regularly with the bad ideas. You know, and again, I keep coming back to the moment that we're in. All of the deregulation, the tax code that benefits the very wealthy and corporations, you know, all of the systems that are in place are because of the ideology of people like Josh Hawley.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you talk about Missouri being working class, let me tell you something that we're really proud of here. And that's that we're the only state in the entire union to overturn right to work legislation by ballot initiative. You know, people look at Missouri like, oh, that's a red state. I'm sorry, but Virginia Virginia is a right-to-work state, right? Missouri is not, because the people of this state on a ballot initiative overturned that legislation, and we did it 68% to 32%. We also increased the minimum wage, $5 over the federal level. And, you know, people look at our kind of look down on the Midwest, but I'm telling you right now, $12 here in Missouri is more than $15 is in New York City or San Francisco, right? People here, working class people, we take care of each other. And I mean, I know that personally. I grew up, you know, my mom got married at 19. My dad wasn't much older. They had four kids before you knew it. You know, my parents were broke. We lived in a working class neighborhood. And when my little sister was born, had to have a heart surgery, we went bankrupt. And the reason we made it wasn't because these country club Republicans on the other side of town were taking care of us. It's not because of the Josh Hollies of the world who were just trying to take more and more for themselves. It's because the people in our neighborhood who had no more money than we did passed the plate for us down at church and brought more tuna casserole by the house than we could ever eat, right? And took care of each other. That's why I joined the Marine Corps, because one of the guys who took care of us was a United States Marine in Vietnam. And that's where we come from. Josh Hawley's a fraud. He went to the fanciest schools. He's a son of a banker. He doesn't know anything about everyday people. You see that in his policies. You see that in the way that he embarrasses himself over and over again. I mean, he actually, you know, he did this bet with another faux populist, J.D. Vance, over the AFC Championship game, which was Chiefs versus Bengals. And he Googled Kansas City barbecue and accidentally bet J.D. Vance Kansas barbecue rather than Missouri barbecue, because the dude is so out of touch. And I'm like, you want to talk about a guy who doesn't care? Like, he doesn't even care enough to do a proper Google search to make sure that he does the right bet, right? And so that's what we're exposing, is the fraudulence and the cowardice. And it's important. It's the front lines in this fight where they are trying to claim they're the party of working people. He's against work. He was against overturning right to wage. He's pro right to work. He's a pro right to work guy. He's an anti minimum wage guy. He doesn't want any of the things we want.
It's funny you bring that up, because, you know, Vance had his own problems in Ohio because he didn't know you put the IO after OH. Oops. And again, if you're gonna be of the people, you got to know what the people are talking about. And look, you know, I know Kansas City barbecue. You don't screw around with that. And I live in Pennsylvania, and I know that.
Again, like, the guy doesn't understand. And the worst part is, like, he doesn't understand us, but he also doesn't even have the courage to learn, right? Like, I don't care if you're a rich kid and you want to be a politician. I don't care if you want to represent people, but you got to have the courage to learn how everyday Missourians live. And that's paycheck to paycheck and one disaster from bankruptcy. And you've got to be willing to help us out. I know what both of those things are like. And that's why I understand what we got going on, why I can reach people. And I'm telling you, we're going to expose this guy as a fraud and a coward every day.
Now, you're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Lucas Kuntz. He's a 13-year Marine veteran, also the Democrat running against Josh Hawley. His website, lucaskuntz.com, the website. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that and maybe participate, maybe throw in a couple of bucks. Now, one of the things you said a moment ago that caught my attention is this idea of community, you know, people bringing, you know, the casseroles over and being part of a bigger community. And I think we have to figure out how to pull that back together. You know, I've said for a very long time, I think the labor movement is a place where we bring that back together, give people the opportunity to make better wages, hours, and conditions in the jobs that they do. But it's also about talking to each other and finding that common ground of community. I just don't see how, you know, someone like Hawley is going to be that person. He talks about unity, talks the game. But, you know, again, looking at January 6th, the things, the rhetoric, the statements, they don't line up.
No, man, he's a fake populist, right? Like real populism, populism of the plains, populism of Harry Truman, you know, something that we have here for a long time. It's not about dividing people and conquering for your own power, which is what he's doing. It's about bringing people together and going against a system that doesn't work for us. I mean, you were just talking about East Palestine, right? Like, Josh Hawley took a junk ton of money from Norfolk Southern, and when he was attorney general here, and you know, didn't do anything on a lot of the water laws and the EPA stuff. He was part of the crew that tried to overturn those, which you're seeing being a problem there, right? Like, I is a country club Republican through and through, who sees a path to power and is trying to take it. And so for me, like, I don't think you can stand for the community when you sell yourself off to massive corporations and strip our communities for parts. I mean, that's what I see here in Missouri, right? I went to Iraq. I went to Afghanistan twice. I deployed for my country, and the hardest thing for me was coming back home and seeing the community, this place that took care of my family when I was a kid, worse off. Like, the first house I ever lived in, it's an empty lot right now, man. It's been torn down. The only new housing in that neighborhood is Habitat houses. The one I joined the Marine Corps out of, like, you know, half the windows aren't there. The corner store is gone. And it just kills me to see these folks who claim to be for working people let Wall Street and massive corporations just strip our communities for parts. They let these hedge funds come in and buy housing. They let them just absolutely destroy us. They don't exercise antitrust. I mean, you want to be a real populist, maybe you should use antitrust. I mean, Josh Hawley says he's against the big tech companies. You know what his anti-big tech company bill was recently? That every single American who signs up on a tech platform has to give the tech platforms their driver's license, birth certificate, social security card and stuff. Like, went after us and our privacy in order to try to put an age limit down instead of actually attacking these companies. And so, you know, for me, again, it's just, it's faux populism through and through. And we're on the front lines of that. We got to fight it every single day here.
Wow. You know, let me ask you this, Lucas, because you talked about the houses you grew up in. And, mm-hmm. and we traveled through Kansas, and you know, we traveled through Iowa, and we traveled through Wisconsin, and we traveled throughout the Midwest, and we saw communities that were broken. We saw communities where the town center is abandoned, and homes were abandoned because the factories left. How did it happen in the neighborhoods that you grew up in? What happened to those places? And then, you know, policy-wise, is there anything we can do to revive that? And what direction, you know, what policies do you fight for? What do you bring back to help revive those communities and help those thrive again?
Absolutely. And so what happened was Wall Street teamed up with our politicians to stop enforcing our antitrust laws because it was going to make them more money to do mergers and acquisitions and can consolidate our infrastructure, our economy, and our production, much of which, once the companies were consolidated, was then shipped overseas, right? But when I talk about consolidation, like St. Louis used to be the headquarters of so many companies. They've now been sold overseas, right? Monsanto was sold to Bayer. So now the profits and things from Monsanto are going overseas to a German corporation. Anheuser-Busch, another flagship company here, was sold to InBev, a Brazilian conglomerate with Belgium. You know, Smithfield, our biggest pork producer, is now owned by China, WH Group. It was sold overseas after we let Big Ag consolidate and destroy all the small farmers. So Missouri used to have the most small pork producers of any state in the entire country. We stopped enforcing our antitrust laws, so that's like Sherman antitrust. But for ag, it's also Packers and Stockyards, you know, stuff like that. We didn't enforce it at all. We let these big corporations take over, and then their shareholders, in order to squeeze a little more value and make profit off of killing off these small farms, then sold themselves overseas. And, you know, another big one's JBS, which is a Brazilian conglomerate. And so we just let these big companies consolidate past the point that they should be, so they have more power over politicians. And just, you know, the snowball effect continues, and we lost our industry. We lost our agricultural base. We lost the profit from our land and our production. Like, it's still happening. It's just getting sucked out of the state rather than staying here. And so what we need to do is we need to rewrite antitrust laws. We need to get these corporate hack judges, who, by the way, Josh Hawley votes for every single one of these corporate hack judges. You know, the dude, when he left law school, he went to a corporate white shoe law firm where these people are coming from, right? It, like, the most elite corporate law firm in the country. And so he votes for all his pals who then support these companies, despite what the law says, over workers, over small businesses and things like that.
See, I think Lucas, I think this is a message that's important for working class people, because and time again, this was the story, whether I was in Ottumwa, Iowa, or Eau Claire, Wisconsin, or Appleton, or, you know, you name the place. This was the story. The story was the local factory, the local identity of that town was sucked away, stripped away because some hedge fund, Bain Capital, or whoever consolidated or sold off or whatever, took the identity of that town away and the jobs with it and left nothing in its place. And communities suffered and struggled, and there was no government. There was no one to step in and fill that void. So to me, I've been asking the question for a decade now. Who's going to be this generation's Harry Truman? Who's going to be this generation's Teddy Roosevelt, the trust buster?
Right.
So I guess the question is, you know, are you that guy? Are you going to be the next Teddy Roosevelt?
So I was so sick of it at the Pentagon. You know, my last tour of duty, I was doing arms control negotiations with Russia, and I oversaw a couple of treaties, and I saw how these defense contractors had consolidated the industry, were stealing all this money from taxpayers, giving us bad products. And so I decided to leave. And, you know, at the same time, I was seeing my old neighborhoods get destroyed, and join a nonprofit, the American Economic Liberties Project, whose sole goal was to do that. Right. We went after big tech. We went after big defense contractors. We went after big ag and several other industries. Big pharma is one of them. Some of the insulin, all the stuff around insulin prices that you're seeing coming out. Sort of initiated that with a few people. We helped run the hearings in Congress against big tech in the House Antitrust, the Judiciary Antitrust Subcommittee, and really tried to expose a lot of this and bring it out into sort of the psyche of the American people. And now what we need to do, now that information's out there and you can see how bad these people are, we need to act on it. And that's what I'm doing. I mean, that's what this race is about. It's about empowering everyday people against a system that doesn't work for them and going against the frauds like Josh Hawley who are keeping that system in place. Because, again, like, let's never, never forget that this guy is a country club Republican, right? That's it. He is a country club Republican, faux populist, who supports all of the things that take away the slack in our communities, the ability of our communities to take care of each other. Like, if you go to my old neighborhood right now, if I were to live there right now, I live in Independence now, not Jeff City, actually Harry Truman's hometown. You can see his house down the street from it. But like that community, they don't have the resources anymore to take care of somebody who goes bankrupt from medical bills. Like, they're that squeezed. And so when we lose that, and when the community loses the ability to take care of each other, then it just falls apart, which is what you're seeing. And so, yes, that is my goal. My goal is to go after these corporations that have bought off our politicians, go after the politicians like Josh Hawley, who give lip service to things while then stabbing you in the back the rest of the time, because I do believe that Missouri is the front line in this fight for working people and for democracy, right? This is the front line where, you know, we have a state where we're willing to overturn right to work legislation 68-32. We're willing to pass this minimum wage. We're willing to claw back power at the ballot box over and over again on these initiatives, because that's what we want. We want the power to lead our own lives again. That's what everyday folks here want. And I plan to be the tip of the spear on that fight and in this thing right here and right now.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Lucas Kuntz. He is running for Senate in Missouri against Josh Hawley. The website, lucaskuntz.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that, maybe make a contribution to the campaign. I ask every candidate the same thing. You know, what's the hill that you die on? What's that issue that is the most important thing to you that there's no compromise on?
I'm dying on money in politics. The way politics is funded right now is the root of most of our problems. I take no corporate PAC money. I take no federal lobbyist money. I take no big fossil fuel company money. I take no big farm executive money. We got a really long list. It's probably the tightest in the entire country. But like my whole purpose of running is power for everyday people, to show folks that you don't have to be a banker's daddy. You don't have to be an heir. You can actually win an election in this country and raise the money to do it from everyday people, and then by doing that, we can actually change the system. And so, you know, a lot of people say I was crazy when I did that. Well, you know, on the first day of the campaign, we raised more money than any candidate statewide ever has, Republican or Democrat, in the state before. We did the same thing the first week because people deserve something that they can believe in. They want something they can believe in. And I am staying pure on that. I'm not going to bend on it. I'm really proud of what we put together, because I do think that we need to win a race, like a real race, a big race, that's not tainted by the wrong money at all, and just show people that's how you can do it. Everyday folks can win again. Because, again, like, you know, I come from a working class neighborhood. My family's got no personal wealth. When my mom got cancer a few years ago, like, she's living with me, right? She had to move in with me, because when you work a job that's essentially an hourly job, and you get cancer and you can't work that job anymore, like, you're screwed, man. You got to go move in with family. People like Josh Hawley, they don't know that. They don't understand that. So they don't care about giving us benefits to survive a situation like that. It's no fault of our own. Like, did my mom go sign up to have lymphoma? No, that's crazy. And so, you know, I'm just bringing that perspective to this thing because I do believe that people with my background should be able to represent each other in the U.S. Senate at the highest levels in our government. And I think if we are able to do that, Like, we're not going to be giving tax credits to the richest people. We're not going to be letting the Saudis buy off our country or China or anybody else, right? We're going to take care of each other. Everyday people aren't idiots. We know what we want. We know what's right.
I was going to cut this short here at this point, but I got to now know about the healthcare situation with your mother. What is she? Is she okay? Did she make it through?
She did. Yeah, she lived with me for a while. She cleared through lymphoma, and she's been in remission for about 10 years, which is really nice. I'm really happy for her.
No, good on her. But you know, the point that I want to get to is, you know, on Twitter and on social media and emails I get from people, mm-hmm. you know, healthcare is one of these things that it's all fine, well, and good that you've got private healthcare until you need it, and you hit on the number one problem that I see, that the second you get sick and you need it. Eventually it goes away, especially if you have a serious illness. This is something that I want somebody with your perspective in the halls of power saying, this is my reality, and I didn't have money to reach into my pocket and fund all of these opportunities for my family. I want somebody who's going to know how difficult it is to deal with insurance companies, you know, and bill and debt collectors and all of the horrible that happens to working people every day.
Absolutely. That's why I'm running. I mean, you know, and I've seen it twice. I saw it when I was a kid and my family went bankrupt from medical bills. And you know, we had a very, very hard life at that point. Right. We really did. And again, the only reason we made it is because people took care of us. I mean, even when I was in high school, we still didn't have any money trying to recover from that. I remember this is another good example of the way that everyday people take care of each other. Right. Like my high school cross country coach, I ran cross country. He saw that I kept getting injured because my parents could only afford to buy me one pair of shoes a year. And when you run that many miles, you're going to get hurt if you don't get another pair of shoes. And I'm going to tell you right now, Missouri pays its teachers 50th in the country, 50th in teachers pay. And that coach, he would secretly buy me a pair of shoes once a year in addition to the one my parents could buy so that I wouldn't get hurt. Like, that guy didn't have any money, but he still took care of his community and took care of a kid who he saw promise in. Like, would I have gotten into college then without that? I don't know. And, you know, the only way I got to go to the college I went to is because I got a Pell Grant from the federal government. We need programs like that to take care of people. So it's on education. It's on health care. You know, I saw it as a kid. I saw it when my mom had cancer. And the problem is, again, we got these faux populist Josh Hollies who say they care about working people. They know nothing about our lives. They know nothing about what it's like to go through these things. And again, they don't even have the courage to learn about it. They don't care to learn about it. They just spout off their talking points and pretend like they care. And again, that's why it's the front line in the fight for our country, for democracy, for working people. And I'm proud to be leading it.
Now, you know, this is another one of those examples where you've got people who have benefited from things who then want to turn around and tear it apart. I look at, you know, Paul Ryan and I share a commonality. We both had a parent who died, and we were able to collect the survivor's benefit from Social Security. The difference is I didn't think it was near enough. My grandparents struggled to be able to take care of me during the years I lived with them. Paul Ryan wanted to destroy it. This is the kind of perspective I think is important to have in the halls of power. So how can people help? I mean, you know, again, I love what I'm hearing, and I hope you'll come back and share more down the road. How can folks help you?
I'd love to. If you can go to Lucas Kuntz Mo on Twitter, you know, that's our Twitter handle, Mo's from Missouri. Follow us there. Spread the word with your friends and family. If you know someone in Missouri, give them a call, shoot him an email, say that you just heard this guy who understands how everyday Missourians live, work and operate, and that he'd be a great representative. Have them follow us. If you can donate, you can go to lucaskuntz.com. My last name is spelled K-U-N-C-E. And, you know, send us a couple nickels. When I talk about the way that we raise money and who we're not raising it from, you know, our average donation is like $30 or something like that. It's one of the lowest in the entire country. We're really proud of that fact because, again, like the only people that I ever want to owe, this is my promise to everyone. It's my promise to myself. The only people I ever want to owe are the folks who took care of me and my family when I was a kid. That's who I'm going to owe when I'm in the U.S. Senate and people like them. And the only way that we can get there is if we all, you know, come together to fund it and make it happen.
No, I'm hopeful for you. I hope folks will go to lucaskuntz.com. We'll get links out on social media. Follow you on the social media channels. We'll get that out as well, and hope folks will follow along. I'm looking forward to this campaign because I think you're going to do great things. Lucas,
thanks,
I appreciate
Rick.
You taking some time for us. Keep up the great work, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
I'd love to. Appreciate you having me.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. No, again, this is one of those moments. And what I've been talking about for ages, working class people throwing their hat in the ring and saying, you know what? We're going to stand up to the power of money. We're going to stand up to the wealthy elite, and we're going to fight. This is good stuff. LucasKunz.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Shaw 101. You're listening to a radio station that's part of the Civic Media Network. Find more at civicmedia.us.
ABC News, I'm Mark Remillard. For the first time in 30 years, the Senate has passed a measure blocking a law passed by Washington, D.C.'s council. It's a crime bill, and 33 Democrats voted with Republicans to block it. Republican Senator Bill Hagerty of Tennessee.
It's gotten so bad that the city recently announced that it's giving away free steering wheel locks to owners of frequently stolen cars here in the district.
The resolution now goes to President Biden's desk. According to prepared remarks obtained by ABC News, Norfolk Southern CEO Alan Shaw will tell a Senate panel tomorrow that he's deeply sorry for the fiery train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio last month. The mother of Breonna Taylor, Tamika Palmer, reacting to a Justice Department report that found a pattern of constitutional violations and discriminatory policing within the Louisville Police Department.
It's heartbreaking to know that everything you've been saying from day one has to be said again. Through this manner.
The investigation was launched after Taylor was killed in a botched raid. This is ABC News.
Fox Valley, regional and state news and commentary. For us to find common ground. Civic Media.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. The city of Madison plans to take car makers Kia and Hyundai to federal court for making their vehicles too easy to steal. Those makes have been targets of widespread thefts in recent months. The mayor says Madison drivers deserve better. Governor Evers tells WisPolitics.com there will be an increase in shared state revenue to local governments in the next budget. Evers says the biggest increase in shared revenue in the last 15 years was only 0.04%.
Not 40, but 0.04%. That's crazy. How can you operate a municipality? I don't care if you're 300 people township or city of Milwaukee.
Particulars on spending increases are still unclear. Republicans are busy reworking the two-year spending plan. In sports, the Bucks beat Orlando last night. The Badgers take on Ohio State in the Big Ten tournament tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Civic Media promised you something big to celebrate our new and still growing network of radio stations. When we announced the one-day $1 million advertising giveaway for Wisconsin businesses, you responded.
Just wanted to echo your sentiments about the advertising. That's really a cool deal and really remarkable.
$1 million of free advertising. Now, if you missed this chance to work with our team, go to civicmedia.us and click on the sponsorship tab. One of our local sales pros will get right back to you. Civicmedia.us and sponsorship.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
Earl Ingram.
Mandela Barnes.
Yeah, the stories that I talked about, the stories I share, my own personal experience was not much different from the experience from a lot of other people across the state. People generally want to be able to, you know, exist together in harmony.
Working hard every day to inform, enlighten, and bring our community together. The Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings 8 to 11 on Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
I asked what kind of family she wanted. She said, a family like yours.
Learn more about adopting a teen at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as you know, we've been following this case down in Florida for a while. You had a a county state attorney who evidently Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, was not happy with, believed that he said something. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I don't know. But decided that he, DeSantis, the governor, thought he had the power to suspend this person and put his lackey into that position. You know, because, you know, prosecutors don't have discretion, evidently, in Florida. They got to do exactly what the governor tells them to do. And this kind of dictatorial mindset is very scary to me. And I'm glad to see that the guy that is at the center of this is fighting back. And the story today is that his federal suit is now being expedited. Maybe at some point very soon, this guy will get back on the job where the voters of that area said, we want you as our state attorney. But that's why I've asked Andrew Warren to come talk with us. He is the suspended state attorney at the center of all of this. Andrew, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks so much for having me back.
So really quick, you know, give me the background. How did this, for folks who don't know, how did this transpire? What's the underlying of this suspension?
Sure. Well, this happened back in August of last year. Out of nowhere, a representative from the governor's office and a couple local deputy sheriffs showed up and basically handed me a piece of paper, said, you've been suspended and need to leave the building right away. And we called it a political stunt from the beginning, that there was no legal basis for the suspension. We ended up filing a suit in federal court in September. The case went to trial in November and into the beginning of December. It was a 3-day trial. And then in January, the judge made a ruling. And the judge's ruling was pretty interesting. It said that the governor's allegations against me were wrong, that there was no basis whatsoever, that the governor's suspension of me was politically motivated and violated both federal and state law. But then the judge said that as a federal judge, this was essentially a state court issue and he didn't have the power to reinstate me. So that's where we ended up at the end of January. We ended up filing an appeal just on that narrow issue of whether the court, a federal court, does have jurisdiction to reinstate an elected official who is suspended in violation of federal and state law. And we've also filed a challenge in state court as well.
And as I remember, the judge, you know, ruled that DeSantis administration and Ron DeSantis violated the Florida Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. And still that sticks to this day. So regardless of what they did and how wrong they were, they're still getting away with it every day that you're not seated in that office. Now, look, I understand the wheels of justice grind slowly and all of that, but it seems like time after time, these people break the law and do these things, and there's never any repercussion. What's the repercussion for a governor like DeSantis from attacking a state's attorney like you? Is there anything on the books that says there's something that they're accountable on?
Well, there is. I mean, we have laws in this country, and elected officials are expected to follow the law just like everybody else. I mean, it's basic value of our country, right? No one's above the law, not even Ron DeSantis, not even the president. And so, it's extremely frustrating on one hand that I haven't been reinstated yet. But on the other hand, you know, we fought back to stand up for free speech and for democracy, the idea that our elections matter, and for the rule of law.
Right.
And the governor and I can disagree all day long about, you know, what criminal justice policy makes sense. We can disagree about, you know, other public policy. How we can disagree about college football and, you know, who should be the first pick in the upcoming draft. But you can't suspend someone because you don't like, you know, what they stand for. You don't like who they are. And the court found that there was no legal basis to suspend me under the very narrow power granted to the governor under Florida law, and that by suspending me because it was politically motivated, it becomes a First Amendment violation as well. So that's what we're fighting back. This isn't just about me getting my job back. This is about making sure your question addressed, that elected officials are held accountable, that the governors are held accountable, that the rule of law still means something in the state of Florida, even though Ron DeSantis is the governor.
Yeah. Now, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, I guess they've agreed to expedite this. I'm assuming they're going to find, as the lower court found, Does this put you back to work, or does this have to go back? Does this have to go further on to another appeals process and eventually to the Supreme Court? What's the path to getting you back where you're supposed to be? What's the path?
Well, our hope is that the 11th Circuit will end up making a decision to reinstate me. I mean, you can never predict these things. That's why we go to court and we argue about it and we litigate it and we trust the judiciary to make the right decision.
Do they have the power to put you back in your position? I mean, since the other federal judge said, I don't have the power to do that, I'm a federal judge, could this appeals court, could they do the same thing?
They could. I mean, they could do it a couple ways, right? They could agree with what the lower court said. They could disagree and reverse it. You know, we are raising this in two forums now because, one, we believe that the federal court does have jurisdiction. That is, the lower court did have the jurisdiction to reinstate me, especially after the clear, unambiguous, and compelling findings that the court made about what I didn't do and what the governor did do in breaking the law. And we also filed in Florida, the Florida Supreme Court, to say, look, whether or not a federal judge has authority to order the governor to do something, the state court clearly does. So we'll see what happens in those two cases. But as I've said before, I mean, this is about far more than me and my job. This is really about, it's not even political, right? I mean, people are trying to make it political, Republican versus Democrat, et cetera. But if it were a Democratic governor who suspended a Republican state attorney, I would hope that people are just as upset and outraged as they are about this. I mean, that's not the way our democracy works in this country.
No, absolutely. And the reason that I'm asking so many questions is because I see this as the future. If DeSantis is able to get away with this, and so far he has, this is going to be the model that I think you see in other authoritarian-minded leaders. I look at Georgia right now, and there's a proposal that's going around there that's going to evidently give new oversight of prosecutors by the legislature because evidently they don't like Fannie Willis. And who knows if they go in and they throw her out because of some made up allegation, if for no other reason than to just stall and run out the clock until her term is over, thus denying people, you know, what her job is supposed to be. I'm looking at this because there's no consequences at this point. There doesn't look like there's any consequences to this. So I'm looking at this as what we can expect to see time and time again. So you're kind of the test case here, it seems.
Well, I don't disagree with you. I mean, there have been politicians around the country talking about, well, we need the power to, you know, throw out other elected officials from office. And to go back to Georgia for a minute, you know, the legislature passed the law just a couple nights ago. And look, let's assume just for a moment that this is not the worst case scenario in terms of their intentions. They're not doing this because the district attorney in Atlanta is investigating Donald Trump and they want to remove her purely for political reasons, which would be just a terrible thing and a mockery of our judicial system and of our democracy. So let's assume just for a moment that they really have good intentions. They're trying to create oversight for elected prosecutors.
Okay, I'm going to go along on this fantasy journey with you. Tour guide along.
Let's go on this journey for a minute. Let's just assume. Look, we all want elected officials to do their jobs well. We all want them held accountable for what they're supposed to do. But the moment you make other elected officials have the power to fire them and give them that oversight, you're not creating accountability. You're creating political fealty. You're making sure that people are loyal to other elected officials, which is not the way our democracy works. What that's doing, and again, assuming that good intentions are here, trying to create accountability, you're not at all. And what you're doing is taking power away from the one group of people who should have elective power in a democracy, and that's the voters, the people. If someone doesn't like the job that an elected official is doing, the solution is simple. They vote them out at the ballot box.
Yeah, we've got the ultimate term limiter, the ability to go to the polls and throw the bums out. We can do that. But the people in your area said, we want Andrew Warren as our attorney, And they are the ones who are supposed to be the deciders in this. So to have a governor, and this is my frustration. It's my frustration on a lot of these things. You get people who break the laws and don't seem to care about it, and there's no repercussion. What's the worst thing that happens to Ron DeSantis in this, or any governor? We'll just throw out any governor who decides that they're going to overreach and usurp their power and throw you to the curb and fight this long, costly battle for the taxpayers and put their person into that position for, you know, 6 months, 8 months, a year. What's the repercussion? What's the penalty? Nothing.
Well, hopefully the penalty is that the American people, whether it's the voters in Florida or some other state, if we're talking about a different governor, look at that and say, we don't want someone who is willing to break the law to advance their own political agenda. You want someone who says, and I've had people come up to me and say, hey, you know, I didn't vote for you and I like the governor, but this is wrong. And that's what gives me confidence in this. You know, you ask what the punishment is. Well, the punishment is maybe you get kicked out of office, right? Because when governors overreach, when they abuse their authority, when they show that they're willing to trample on people's constitutional rights to push whether it's legitimate policy or just to promote their own political ambitions, hopefully the voters see that and say, we don't want that person as a leader in our state or in our country. But we also have courts that need to step in and say, look, when someone breaks the law, we're going to hold them accountable and we're going to tell them you can't do this and impose the appropriate remedy.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Andrew Warren. He is the suspended state attorney in Florida. You can check out his website, AndrewWarrenFL.com. We'll get links out on social media. Again, this is a travesty of justice in my view. Now, the last line of questioning I want to get into, because, you know, there's this thing called prosecutorial discretion. As a prosecutor, people have the right to choose to take, you know, cases, to not take cases. This kind of mindset that you're going to have a unitary executive who's going to then impose this is the kind of things that we're going to, you know, hyper prosecute. This isn't our system. I think the strength of our system is that we have a diverse kind of people who, I'm trying to put this in a way. There's a diverse thought of you know how we go after enforcing laws and how seriously and vigorously on different laws. I think I'm struggling on this. Help me here. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. I do. I mean, you're absolutely right. Well, you know, prosecutorial discretion manifests in a couple different ways, right? We have policy priorities that you want elected officials, whether they're prosecutors or legislators or the president, you want those elected officials to make their priorities clear and to be transparent and to follow through on them. And that's how voters should, you know, end up deciding who they want in those positions. I've made it a priority that we should be going after violent criminals and serious fraudsters and the repeat offenders. And, you know, I don't believe that we should be using resources to be super tough on low-level offenders and, you know, as opposed to the violent offenders. If you disagree with that policy, okay, don't. But that is one piece of prosecutorial discretion. The other piece of this court, of course, is at a case-by-case level. And this is where, you know, the narrative just gets completely confusing and, like, with a bumper sticker slogans that you see politicians talking about. These decisions are really hard. Yeah. Prosecutors, you know, look at all the facts, all the evidence. They look at criminal history. They look at how much, you know, their ability to prove the case and how they can bring those witnesses and their ethical considerations. And I could go on and on and on. And so to have someone who is not a prosecutor, who's not involved in the system, say, I don't know, I think you should have prosecuted this case, or I think you shouldn't have prosecuted this case, or I think you should have sought a longer punishment or a shorter punishment. It's really hard to do that from afar, because those decisions are so fact intensive, which is why, again, assuming people have good intentions in trying to create oversight for prosecutors, what you end up doing is just having people who are going to become political loyalists and don't end up making the decisions the way our system is meant to operate, which is promoting public safety and protecting people's constitutional rights.
Now, I mean, see, I look at the job of a state's attorney or a prosecutor as, you know, I want someone who's going to enforce the laws evenly, equally, and not with an ideological bent. I want to go after rapists and murderers and you know, fraudsters, and maybe not so much after, like in South Carolina, the woman that they arrested for taking the birth control pill that everyone's all up in arms about. You know, maybe not as vigorously enforced. I don't know. I'm struggling with the direction that some want to take us. It's frightening, and to see this kind of thing happen, you know, it's going to happen more often, which is why I'm hoping that as this goes down the road, that you're made whole, you're returned to your position, and this is pushed back on so it doesn't happen again. But Andrew, I appreciate you taking time for us, sharing your thoughts. I hope folks will check out the website, andrewwarrenfl.com. We'll get links out on social media. I appreciate the time, Andrew. Thank you.
Absolutely, Rick. You have a great night.
Thanks so much. Seriously, and I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. You may know that March is Women's History Month, but did you know why it takes place each year in the month of March? It all goes back to today in labor history. The year was 1857. That was the day that hundreds of women working in New York City's garment industry went on strike. The women demanded better wages, safer working conditions, a 10-hour workday, and equal rights. In the years that followed the historic strike, March 8th became an important time for women workers to rally in the city. So on March 8th, 1908, a crowd of 15,000 women workers in New York took to the streets. The marching women demanded the right to vote, an end to sweatshops, and a halt to child labor. At the International Socialist Congress in 1910, a German woman named Clara Zetkin proposed March 8th be declared as International Women's Day. Women from 17 countries agreed, and over the years, the day continued to hold a special place for women in the labor movement. Women from Bangladesh to South Africa to Venezuela have held demonstrations for workers and civil rights on this day. By 1980, President Jimmy Carter declared the week surrounding March 8th Women's History Week. His declaration read in part, "Too often, the women were unsung, and sometimes their contributions went unnoticed. But the achievements, leadership, courage, strength, and love of the women who built America was as vital as of the men whose names we know so well." In 1987, the week was expanded, and March became known as Women's History Month. And it all started with garment workers who were not afraid to stand up for their rights, leading the way for countless numbers of other women who have bravely followed in their footsteps. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2. RickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email rick@thericksmithshow.com. So Michael Flynn evidently going to be suing the government for $50 million. Or let me do it like Michael Myers. $50 million. Because he was evidently on the grounds of wrongful prosecution. And look, you're going to see a lot of this whining from the criminal class on the right because of the Tucker Carlson video. This is all, they didn't show us the videos. And my argument was from the beginning, had Kevin McCarthy put people on that committee to fight back, to question witnesses, to put up an actual defense of Donald Trump? Because again, the system is supposed to be, you know, both sides, you know, going after the witnesses. Kevin McCarthy made the choice, made the calculated decision not to engage in the January 6th committee because he knew he was wrong. He knew his own statements were going to be brought up against him. He knew people like Scott Perry. I wanted Scott Perry on the committee. I wanted him in the room. I wanted him on the dais so that when I have a question or someone has a question, go, you know, when people have, you know, cell phone communications, you know, Scott Perry, you know a little bit about this. What about your cell phone communications? What were you doing on that day? For me, I think that would have been great. They knew better. They decided to pull out of it completely. They wanted nothing to do with it because they didn't want to have to defend Trump. They didn't want to have to defend the criminals. And they knew that we, you know, we as Americans have, we've got short attention spans. Eventually, the seriousness of this was going to pass. Eventually, the media power of the right-wing spin machine was going to take over, and we were going to normalize it. It was a patriotic day of picnickers in the park. It was a day of families taking pictures. Look at how orderly they were. They walked between the ropes. Look at them. Look at the video of them shooting Ashley Babbitt. Here's the thing. And I've had a bunch of people email me going, they murdered, she's a martyr. No. She's a criminal. She was told, do not breach this door. Do not come through this door. Can you imagine, had she gotten on the other side of that door and opened that door for the throngs of angry people shouting, hang Mike Pence, to have access to all those people who were just behind those folks in Congress, those representatives who were cowering in fear, waiting for them to be swinging from the rope. Had she gotten through, had she opened those doors, it's a different country right now. Now, I can't imagine that she wasn't told numerous times, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. But again, it's the narrative that she's a martyr. And the reality is, you know, I remember, you know, watching the videos that she posted, you know, on the way to January 6th. This poor woman she drank the Kool-Aid. This woman truly bought the idea that they were going to, this was a revolution. They were going to stop the steal. They were going to overturn this and they were going to right the wrong because they bought the big lie. They bought it hook, line, sinker. They bought the whole thing. Baby, bathwater, spigot, they bought it all. And they were going because they thought history was going to remember them as patriots because they were going to water the tree of liberty. They were going to be remembered in history. And look, Ashley Babbitt will be remembered in history. Her name will be remembered. I don't know how it's going to be remembered, to be honest with you. Because we're in a weird moment. We're in a moment where history isn't settled yet. History is going to remember her as someone who, an unfortunate victim of right-wing insanity, who put herself in a position where she should have never put herself in and died as a cause of it. Or, you know, the right is going to, you know, we're going to have the Civil War and they're going to rewrite the history of the day and make her a martyr and the beginning, you know, the Crispus Attucks of this revolution. And the sad reality is you know, these folks bought a lie. It was a lie. And the people who continued to tell the lie and still to this day tell the lie knew it was a lie. And they did it because it was all about the money. You know, someone, you know, sent me an email saying that in Tucker Carlson's book, he talks about Bill O'Reilly and how Bill O'Reilly's got this great shtick as, you know, the everyday working man and, you know, this loose Catholic, this, you know, this tough guy. And he said, you know, if anyone found out what he was really like, it would all fall apart. Same thing for Tucker Carlson. We now see behind the curtain. We now see who Tucker Carlson really is and has always been It's always been about the money. And I've been saying this for years about right-wing media. It's about the sale. It's not about the policy. It's not about making your life better. It's about lining their pockets at your expense. So the question is how much longer are we going to put up with it? I hope the folks who are there are reading it. I hope there's a Lonesome Roads moment. I'm just not hopeful. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast, wherever you get yours, find ours. Appreciate you tuning in. We'll see you back here next.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.